All right, everybody, welcome everyone to the first FOMC panel of 2025. There's a lot of stuff to touch on today. A lot of stuff has happened since our last FOMC panel in December. So I'm excited to get our panelists' takes on recent data and how things are starting to look as we traverse into 2025. Now, those of you who have attended these panels before know how much I like to keep the dialogue open, so we don't have to worry too much about chiming in. If there's anything you want to add to another speaker's points, jump right in and do so. The only request I have from the panelists is to leave a breath of air in between when the other speaker stops and you start, just to avoid any feedback or background noise. So everybody, let's go ahead and dive right into this while we await our other panelists to get on up here. First up, we've got our go-to Fed guy, Joseph Wang. As many of you know, he headed trading at the Fed's open markets desk, has a great introductory book I always love to plug on these called Central Banking 101, and is the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph. Exciting one today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And great to see Marco joining as well. Marco has some really good takes on all the inflation data. So look forward to hearing from that as well.
And with that said, let's jump straight to Marco. Marco Bjektovic is the founder and CEO of Arcomino Research, where he provides in-depth research on U.S. macroeconomics and markets as a whole. Marco has around two decades of experience working in the markets as an equity broker, investment advisor, manager, even as chief bank macroeconomist. Now, we've had Marco before, and his forecasts and analysis help educate and inform investors the world abroad. And I'm really excited to have you back, Marco. How's it going?
How are you? Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Joseph. I think this is going to be awesome today. So I'm really excited.
So am I, Marco. Thanks for coming back. Next, we've got the last bear standing, another friend of the spaces. Love having him here. He's an expert on markets, where he writes about monetary policy in his weekly Substack that if you're not subscribed to, you definitely should be. There's a lot of good, as they call it, alpha coming right out of Last Bear. Welcome back, Last Bear.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. As always, I always appreciate getting the invite to the spaces. It's a great occasion every month or so. So I'm looking forward to it and looking forward to what everyone has to say on the panel.
As am I. And next, we've got our volatility expert, the man himself, sprinkling crumbs all over the Twitter spaces area, Jem Carson, the founder of Kai Volatility. I know you guys have had a lot of stuff coming out over the last year or so, Jem, so I'm really excited to hear your takes on some of these whiplashes we're seeing in the markets the last few days.
Yeah, always wonderful being here. This has been a regular highlight for several years now. And I think for those that tuned in last time, we sprinkled some crumbs in real time. I think really we're able to call that decline that came almost immediately after the Fed last time in real time there. And I think that's just a testament to kind of the value here that these spaces provide, really actionable insights. So always wonderful being here. Really respect everybody on here, and thanks for having me.
Thanks as always for coming. With that, everybody, let's not put this off any longer. So let's take a quick macro overview since our last FOMC panel. CPI for November came in up 0.4%, bringing the year-over-year to 2.9%. GDP in the U.S. expanded at an annualized rate of 3.1%, with personal spending, believe it or not, rising at its fastest rate since 2023. The new administration in the White House has sent waves across all sectors, ranging from threats of tariffs on numerous countries, including some trade partners, as well as on goods such as steel, such as happened during Trump's prior stint in office. In addition to an apparent blackout of communication on medical entities in the U.S., and we had that situation not too many days ago with Chinese AI company DeepSeek sending NVIDIA into a tumble that set records for single stock market cap loss in a single day. And so I want to start right off, and we'll get to everything in that intro and more, but I want to jump right to the topic at hand here. And that being the topic of rate cuts. It's been a bit less dovish than a few prior meetings we've covered. and the opinion of maintaining current rates or putting off that cut until March is quite popular, as is the notion that rates will be cut today. That said, FedWatch has a 99.5% probability that we pause once again today. Now, aside from the likelihood of a pause, Trump recently said that he will, quote, demand interest rates be lowered, and that Powell will work with him on that, that Powell will listen to that desire. So, Joseph, first off, what do you kind of project from the FOMC meeting today? And second, can the president directly force a rate cut from the Fed? What's the relationship there?
Well, like you mentioned, the market is pricing in basically nothing today to a very high probability, and the Fed does not like to surprise markets, so nothing will happen today. Now, right now, looking at the markets, we're only pricing in about two cuts this year, and not too long ago, we were only pricing in one cut. So what's been happening over the past month is that the inflation data has come in a little bit better than expected. So what the Fed likes to look at is PCE, and PCE this month, based on the Cleveland Fed Now projection, is going to come in about 0.18% month over month, which annualizes to around the Fed's target. And we also had Governor Waller come out and say that he's open to Fed cuts before the first half of this year. And that kind of has set a dovish tone. So the market has priced in more than one cut this year. What was your other question again?
Whether or not Trump's demand. Yeah. Whether or not that has really any bearing on the Fed.
That was a really funny clip we can find on X where the reporter asked Trump, do you think the Fed will listen? And Trump was like, yeah. So the Fed is very clear about its monetary policy independence. And I think Trump is going to respect that. But when you listen to what Trump talks about at Davos, he links his demand for lower interest rates with oil prices. And so he's telling everyone that he's trying to go and get oil prices down, either by encouraging drilling in the US and or political pressure on OPEC. And we all know OPEC has a lot of spare capacity. So they could, in theory, increase supply and put downward pressure on oil prices. Now, if you look at the historical relationship between oil prices and inflation, now we don't consume crude oil directly, but we consume refined products like gasoline and stuff like that, fuel oils. So the price of crude oil is tightly linked to the price of gasoline. So when crude oil comes down, you can see headline inflation coming down. You can see inflation expectations coming down. Historically, there's a very strong relationship between these two. And there's some work that suggests that with a lag, it also puts downward pressure on core inflation. And with inflation just a little bit above target right now, it seems like if Trump were to be able to get oil prices down, and I don't know if he can, that would be helpful in getting rate cuts. But I suspect the easiest way, if he really wanted to get rate cuts, is not to order the Fed around it, but really just to go on with his task of having huge tariffs. That, I think, if I remember 2018, 2019 correctly, is very bad for risk assets and does get you rate cuts.
Well said. I want to touch a little bit on that oil commentary here in a moment. But Jem, I saw you unmuted earlier. Did you have something to add to
it? Nothing specific. I do think that this is a critical turning point because of the new administration and the pressure that is clearly being put upon the Fed. It is not just the external communication and what we're hearing, but there you have to appreciate the fact that the Federal Reserve is, if not the biggest, one of the two biggest levers of power in America. And Donald Trump very much and the administration has every goal, every intent to control as much of the levers of power as possible, especially early on in the administration. So I think that is a focus here today. And I think what the Fed says here, importantly, is it's less important about the actual, whether it's 50 basis points that they project for the year or 25 or 75 or 100. It's what it tells you about that dynamic and what the general trajectory, which is more so than other meetings, may change as a function of that political relationship. So that's the one thing that Joseph kind of highlighted, but I think an important focus as we kind of read the tea leaves today.
And before I move along, Last Bear and Marco, did you have any overview comments before we jump into that oil topic here?
Actually, everyone is, of course, focused on inflation currently, but I think that actually the labor market will be what drives Fed decisions going forward, especially over the next few meetings. If the unemployment rate starts to go up, we could see a more dovish Fed. We could see a few more cuts. And if the unemployment rate doesn't go up, actually, I don't know. Maybe they pause for a little time here. So this is how I see the things. It's probably more about the unemployment rate than inflation at this point.
Last Bear, anything to add to Marco? Jump to oil and back to labor.
Yeah, I think that was a great point by Marco, just on the importance of the employment market. And I do think we've seen sort of a dynamic where for the past maybe almost 2 years, maybe a little more than 2 years, we've seen financial markets sort of easing from a point of sort of peak fear, let's say late 2022, when rate cuts were still rate increases were happening at a rapid rate. It was unclear exactly where inflation was going to go and how high they'd have to go. But since sort of late 2022, we've seen declining credit spreads. We've seen declining volatility. We've obviously seen the stock market increase. We've seen capital market activity increase. And so on the financial markets, we've already seen sort of this maybe early sort of expansionary stage increase in terms of, credit and money and that sort of thing. But we haven't necessarily seen that come through in terms of an inflection in the labor market, which continues to sort of gradually weaken if you look at all these different dynamics from job openings or hiring rates or whatever. Those are not in horrible positions, but they continue to sort of trend downward and we haven't seen an inflection. So I think to Marco's point, if those continue to go down, it will show the Fed that in the real economy, their rate cuts haven't necessarily translated to an improvement overall and sort of a downward decline labor market. On the other hand, if we do see that start to plateau or start to increase, I think it would give the Fed an indication that this new cycle really has started to take off in an expansionary way and that further rate cuts maybe are not necessary or maybe even unwise when thinking about inflation over the long term.
Beautifully said, Last Bear. Thank you. I will dive deeper into labor a little later on. And if my frazzled ADHD brain forgets, Joseph, feel free to reach through that screen and give me a nice little smack. So I'm going to jump back to oil, some comments that Joseph mentioned earlier. Trump's been very, very vocal about requesting more output from OPEC, the main target there being to bring the price of oil down. However, some economists have kind of voiced the concern that in doing so, American producers may be adversely affected, especially those with higher extraction costs. So, Jem, I'm going to pick on you this one, and then anyone else on the panel, please feel free to jump in. How could oil prices be brought down without the potential for hurting American companies, given one of the main and major points of focus for this administration rests on that America First mindset?
Yeah, I mean, ostensibly, like the idea with tariffs is to create economic kind of flow the benefits of policy more directly to American constituents. Obviously, easier said than done. I am skeptical in a free market to ever seal off. Markets are very, very, good at avoiding policy and the constraints of policy, particularly in a global sense. So I do think if we try and incentivize kind of cheaper oil prices by stimulating demand, they may be able to do it, but it would have to be through some type of fiscal kind of benefit to local local producers. Not sure if they could get those things passed, but it's easy to say these things, easy to project the idea of policy, and but once it comes to actually implementing much harder. So I have a degree of skepticism that that will be possible, despite what Joseph said, which is that would be one of several big levers that, that the administration could, in theory, pull to try and control inflationary impacts of other things that they're doing.
Thank you, Jim. So kind of on that same note, the U.S. Energy Information Administration recently said that they forecast benchmark Brent crude oil prices will fall from an average of $81 per barrel throughout 2024 to $74 per barrel in 2025, and then in 2026, further down to $66, citing significant market uncertainties, namely the geopolitical risks that we've touched on briefly, and growing production by non-OPEC companies. And the EIA actually voiced a separate wish than those mentioned by the Trump administration, stating they prefer that OPEC continues to restrain output in both 2025 and 2026. So last bear, from your point of view here, which of those two is more beneficial in terms of production, supply, and demand with oil, or is it a lot more complicated than just that?
Yeah, I think it's, well, the EIA puts out their short-term and long-term projections all the time. I don't know that how accurate those tend to be. I think projecting commodity prices is very hard, even for people who, you know, are very knowledgeable on the subject. I think it's hard for a president. I think it's easy for a president to say that he's going to lower oil prices. In the last administration, they actually did have a major obvious lever in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that they actually could add a substantial amount of supply into the market simply by turning on that faucet, let's say. I think it's a lot harder to do that without that lever at hand if they're not going to use that. I think on the U.S. side, and certainly market-based companies, which, you know, sort of international privately owned oil companies, are very sensitive to market conditions. At the same time, nationally owned oil companies like OPEC countries have a lot more sort of strategic vision in terms of how that interacts with their budget, how they want to protect their market share over longer terms. And so I don't think that OPEC is necessarily just going to listen to President Trump when he says turn on the faucets. I also think it's hard for OPEC. You know, it's easy for us to say, oh, OPEC has excess supply capacity. But practically, that may not be true, especially in countries that have haven't maintained their infrastructure and development costs and haven't been putting the money back in their oil fields to be able to do that. I think places like Saudi Arabia and the UAE potentially have some capacity, but outside of that, it might be a lot less than people think. So I think that the oil market is an important market. It's one that gets a lot of political attention, but it's also one that is much more complicated than tweets from the president. So I think it's really tough to say where oil is going to go in the long term.
I'd say that's fair. And so it's not necessarily the same topic as oil, but kind of in that same area of non-equity markets here, I want to touch a little bit on gold next. Early this month, gold prices took a little bit of a hit, emphasis on little, following comments from the Federal Reserve expressing concerns about persistent inflation. Those remarks reinforced expectations that the central bank might maintain a tighter monetary policy stance. Gold now obviously is up after that tiny little pullback, and it's inching toward that previous all-time high yet again, with some pundits calling for even higher. One example of this would be Mind Money CEO Julia Kondoshko setting a price target of $3,000 mid-year. Marco, I'd love your take on gold here. Are investors as a whole still pretty big bullish on gold? And what does the bullishness in gold, while equities are still churning toward their all-time highs yet again, does that tell us anything well about the market?
Well, I have a bit of different view on gold than probably most people. Actually, I don't see gold as an asset that people are buying because they are afraid of inflation. It's probably more an asset that people are buying when they are anticipating the Fed easing more in the future. Like if they anticipate that the Fed might do more cuts, they're probably going to buy more gold if they anticipate that the Fed might, I don't know, pivot from the QT into another QE. Then of course they might start buying more gold. So actually, the gold story is related to the one of the Fed. Like if you anticipate more easing ahead, then you should probably be bullish on gold. But if you don't, then maybe there is not that much upside, like some people have been talking about.
Thank you, Marco. Jem, would you agree with that sentiment, or are you more on the side of the side of more all-time highs for gold throughout 2025, such as kind of continuously happened throughout 2024?
Yeah, I mean, in 2022, as oil prices were exploding, we were calling for the big trade was at the bottom there, 2050 or so in gold, to buy calls with two hands in gold. And the thesis was that twofold. One, that we're in a very populist protectionist period, and that more spending was coming from a fiscal perspective, despite what others think. I do not believe gold is as, and first of all, inflation is not a function of money supply as it is money velocity. The velocity of money in a closed system where all people are equal and spend equally, money supply is what drives things. But that's not how the system actually works. Money can go to the top 0.1% and get stored away or dug in the ground or put into investment, even worse, which is deflationary. Money flowing to people and money supply churning in the system is what increasing in the system is what drives inflation. And as we've seen that as a function of populism, protectionism, that the velocity of the money being sent through stimulus to people through government has increased. That is what has driven what we thought would be coming, which is a structural inflationary push and a flight to quality in gold. The last time we saw this in the 60s and 70s, which I've spoken about ad nauseum now on here and other platforms, this was not a 1-2 year, 4 year outcome. The best performing asset during times of populism when we're taking money from zero velocity to 100 and accelerating that in terms of wealth transfer as well. Gold was the best performing asset by quite a number during that 15 year period. It was also the most volatile asset. So to be clear, this is not just some clean uptrend. Oil performed very well. Industrial commodities are a lot of good structural inflationary hedges that worked during that period, but they worked in very different ways and to different scales. And gold, and you could argue Bitcoin as well, are likely to continue to perform incredibly well during what is a structural a decade plus beginning of the story, but it's likely to be incredibly volatile along the way. The clean uptrend we saw at the beginning of that move, since we called for that, the greatest surprise of that, in my view, is that it wasn't more volatile until more recently. And so I would expect a widening, almost like megaphone, with increasing prices as time goes on. If you think it's going to be a straight line and you're getting shaken out by, again, in your words, the minuscule pullback that we've seen, you're missing the big picture. There are very few ways to truly hedge against structural inflation. And this is one of the best ways since time incarnate to do that. So it is not a matter of whether interest rates go down or up, maybe in the very short term, in a monthly, quarterly, maybe even an annual perspective, more monetary supply will stimulate in the short term, but the past that period, monetary supply is not a inflationary pressure, I know that's an unconventional way to think about it, as much as the velocity of that monetary supply. And that is really a function of government policy. And that's what's driving this this push. It really is a function of the tariffs, the fiscal spending that we've seen for multiple administrations now, the global conflict, and also commodity pressures that we're seeing.
Thank you, Jim. And I will be picking your brain a little bit more about volatility later. And I just got to say, man, hell of a call out. For those who don't know, back in November, somebody on Twitter asked, when does the SPX fill the gap it created with election results? And Jim responded, Jan 13th, plainly and simply, and I'll be damned. Jan 13th came along, my man. What a call out.
Thanks, buddy. No, I appreciate that. You know, that obviously generates a lot of excitement and interest, and I don't want to belittle or, you know, but we deal in probabilities. And we have now on, you know, three or four occasions in the last 4 or 5 years nailed days, months in advance. That's not the first one. February 22 decline, we also called that 3 months almost to the day in advance of that bigger structural decline. There are a couple things like that, but those are by playing probabilities. You bet the odds. There's higher, significantly higher odds in different windows. And I think the bigger thing is understanding how the machine works. And understanding why those things are possible. And so that's what we're trying to kind of drill down here. It's less focused on that one day, but really how you can do that more broadly with path and understanding broad direction. But I appreciate the kind words and the response that people have given.
Got ourselves the time traveling croissant on the board. Did anybody, Joseph, Last Bear, or Marco, have anything to add there to the gold discussion before I move us?
Yeah, I'll add something. So gold is kind of, you know, has different roles. Like Jim mentioned, it's often thought of as an inflation hedge. And as Marco mentioned, oftentimes reacts to monetary policy as well. But one other thing that gold is very good is a hedge for against government, basically, especially in geopolitical times. So one of the big things that we've seen in the market is that big countries like China have been increasing their gold holdings. And that makes total sense because we're heading into a time where, you know, maybe the U.S. is going to have more geopolitical boundaries and maybe there's going to be less of a unipolar world. Maybe there'd be changes in how the global monetary system works. Maybe it's not just going to be completely dollar centric. So if you are China and you have tons of dollars, which you do, trillions and trillions, and you also notice that you're not the best friends with the U.S., and you also see how your friend Russia, you know, when things don't go well with the U.S., you can lose access to all your money. You have to diversify. And gold is kind of special in that it's an asset that doesn't have a counterparty. If you have, say, a treasury, it's going to be held in custody somewhere. So you do have some counterparty risk. If you have a deposit at a bank, there's also the bank is your counterparty. And we've seen that the U.S. can, through its network of alliances, basically make your money go poof. So if you are a country that, you know, is not on best terms with the U.S., and it's not just China, there are many other countries, I think, who don't want to be under this kind of potential threat, you want to diversify your funds so that you can hold a little bit more gold. And one thing I'll add is that we've seen recently that the Chinese trade surplus is around $1 trillion. Now, that's an enormous amount of money. That means every year they have $1 trillion coming in, and a lot of it's going to be in dollars. So they have to buy something. They don't want to buy treasuries all day or even US dollar assets because they could lose access to that. So it's just kind of prudent management for a lot of countries who may not be the best friends with the US.
Yeah, one thing I'll add to that. So incredible, important point by Joseph, and really can't emphasize that enough. That, and we talked about this a while back, Joseph and I talked about on here, you know, global conflict, which again, you look at other periods where we've had inflation, is a major driver of inflation. And for these exact reasons, right? Supply chains break down, people don't trust one another, things become more inefficient, and then people chase hard assets to help protect. Kind of against a lack of being able to to avoid counterparty risk, to avoid conflict. But it's important to understand that that global conflict is intrinsically tied to populism. Right? The cousin or brother of populism is protectionism. You can't have a populist policy without closing your borders or incentivizing internal America first or whatever country first. Protectionism goes hand in hand with populism. And the reason we get increasing periods of global conflict and these types of trends is because of protectionism. When we are no longer collaborating, when we're no longer sending money to corporations and favoring profits and cooperation to make profits, and instead of worrying about our people internal to the country, the actual individuals, that's a very different type of policy. We are now competitive as opposed to cooperative. And that leads, not surprisingly, since time incarnate, to territorial disputes, to all kinds of power disputes. That's animal human nature. And so that is what is a secondary and yet just as important driver, but they're tied together. And I guess the third piece I will say in addition is more inflation in the U.S. begets more fiscal concerns for a country with debt. I'm not the first person to highlight those issues, although I think in the long term, it is not as critical. In the short term, that will create concern at some point about the value of the dollar, et cetera, particularly in a U.S. System. In a system that has more kind of global conflict and protectionism, that at some point, all these pressures, global conflict, inflation, higher interest rates will eventually create a less of a trust, which is we're starting to see as well in the dollar potentially. And so back to Joseph's point, it will also drive people looking to diversify away in ways over time. So I think these are all related. They all drive down to kind of this broad populist reality and the inflation that we're seeing. But once these cycles get going, there's multiple different points that just drive massive tailwinds for gold.
Jim, and that reminds me on the topic of foreign nations kind of diversifying their Forex as well. I remember in 2024 and a little bit there at the tail end of 2023, there was a lot of I don't want to say actual concern, because it kind of sounded like from the point of view of the panelists, it wasn't that much of a concern as it was being made out to be. But in the media, there's a lot of concern of countries moving away from the U.S. dollar and investing in other country currency. Is that even really on anyone's radar anymore? I don't think I've really heard anything about that.
I think Trump said that he would sanction you if you did not use the dollar.
So that might be why we haven't heard too terribly much about it this few weeks. So I want to tickle back to that topic of labor just a little bit. The Richmond Federal Reserve President Tom Barkin noted that while the U.S. economy appears stable, the labor market warrants close observation specifically. And I know Marco was touching on this earlier as well. Barkin emphasized a little bit of uncertainty regarding potential labor market weakening, and he highlighted that topic of core inflation, that although it's reduced from previous levels, it's still quite a bit above the Fed Reserve's 2% target. So, Marco, if you don't mind just kind of touching this one a little bit, what really is going on in the labor markets that pose this cause for concern?
Well, there are a lot of concerns here, even though most people don't really talk about them. For example, when you look at the headline numbers like non-farm payrolls, they are currently reported at 256,000 for December. But this number is really like it's subject to revisions. And there are two types of revisions. You have monthly revisions that usually happen month to month. And then you have these annual revisions that happen only once a year. And we will get them soon. So actually, we are tracking the data, and currently annual revisions are the preliminary data from September tells us that non-farm payrolls could be overstated by about 70K per month on average, and this was for the period from April to March 2024, April 2023 to March 2024. We don't know what's happened after March 2024, but let's just assume that situation probably hasn't changed much, and that there could be some significant revisions here as well. This is regarding the annual revisions, and regarding the monthly revisions, they are currently tracking at about 33K per month on average for 2024. So actually, if you apply all of that, you can easily subtract like 100K each month that you get some numbers, like maybe this month it will be a bit higher and the next month it will be a bit lower, but on average it's probably around that, like 100K per month. So it's not 250, it's probably closer to 150 for December. But when you take something like 3 month average, and you actually take into account all these revisions, you come to about 100K, because these 3 months are also including the October payroll number, which was, of course, everyone knows that, affected by the hurricanes. So like 100K, it's still like a positive number. It's not like that the economy is shedding jobs, but it's still not like that it's gaining jobs on a large scale like 250K would suggest. So this is one thing. The other thing is the unemployment rate, especially which with some things that we heard over the last days. Including this Trump's order to compensate some government workers, to offer them to take some benefits until September if they voluntarily quit from their jobs. And I've been doing some math here. The government is looking to get. They think that around 5 to 10% of all government workers will actually take this offer. If that happens, the unemployment rate could go to 4.7% or 5.4% immediately. Like if all of these people are going to just be just not work for the government anymore. Maybe some of them will find jobs in the private sector, but who knows? Maybe not all of them will find jobs. So actually, we could be looking at the unemployment rate going up. So this is something like an uncertainty that no one knows what will happen at this point, whether these people will accept this offer, whether Trump will, I don't know, maybe fire some of them if they don't accept this offer. We don't know. So actually, this is kind of like pretty uncertain, and this is something that is probably bothering the Fed at this moment. And this is precisely the reason why they probably cannot make much of accurate assessments at this time, because it all depends on what Trump administration will do at this point. So they don't know what they are going to deal with in a month or two or three, maybe if this unemployment rate goes up or it doesn't. Who knows? Maybe just 1% of the government workers will be laid off in this thing. So actually, for example, if it's only 1% of the government workers, then the unemployment rate would just go up by a tenth or maybe two tenths of a percentage point. So this is not actually like a lot or something that would scare the Fed at this point. But we actually don't know what will happen.
Thank you, Marco. I want to touch a little bit more on something else that has sprinkled some uncertainty in some ways, and that being the immigration policy changes we're seeing, the mass deportation that the Trump administration has put underway for undocumented immigrants. In terms of the labor force, some of the numbers I was looking at for 2024 were honestly a little muddied, but in 2023 and 2022, respectfully, undocumented workers made up upwards of 19% of the U.S. labor force by estimates. And I'm curious, what sort of, if any, effects might we see in the labor markets following or during this potential mass deportation event? Is that going to skew our numbers at all?
I don't know, actually, because I think at this point no one knows what's the actual effect of undocumented workers. Maybe these illegal immigrants that Trump will send away, maybe they weren't employed at all. Maybe they were there just, I don't know, doing some stuff and not really contributing to the economy. We just don't know how many of them or in what percentage have they actually been employed or calculated within these official government numbers. Of course, there are lots of estimates, and this is like, yeah, we can always use some of these estimates if it fits something that we believe or not. But the thing is that actually no one knows it at this point. I think that probably this could have some effect, but maybe this will not be like the determining factor of whether, I don't know, the unemployment starts to pick up significantly or not. This will probably come from other forces, including, I don't know, maybe what he does with government workers, maybe what he does with tariffs, for example, because all the things I hear about tariffs are concentrated on inflation, but nobody's talking about what will happen if, for example, tariffs bring prices up too much. Maybe some products will not be consumed anymore, or worse, services are not on his radar as far as I know, but you get my point. Actually, we don't know the effect of all of these things. If tariffs increase prices too much for certain products, maybe people will say, okay, we are not going to buy anything anymore because we are fed up of, I don't know, consuming this product. We are just going to concentrate on something else entirely. And in that case, actually, there could be a problem with consumption growth going forward. This is something that I haven't seen people talking about much lately, but it's certainly a possibility. So this is something that I see more like a risk going on than this thing about immigration. Of course, immigration it captures a lot of attention, public public attention, it's politically relevant and so on. But there are some, I think that there are some other things that will be more, that will determine what happens with the economy in more than immigration.
Thank you, Marco. Now, Marco brought up tariffs there at the bit, and obviously tariffs is a topic right now. Trump has been very vocal about levying tariffs, and he also has announced his intentions to levy those tariffs on resources such as steel and semiconductors. And if you recall, the 2018 tariffs on steel and aluminum are often cited as an example of the potential for impacts that are negative on American-made goods, such as construction and automotive. Should tariffs be implemented in this fashion, in the severity with which he's discussing, how can these and similar industries offset the cost of imported materials when the price is going to be significantly higher to bring them into the United States? Les Baer, could you start us off on this one, and then we'll kick that bad boy around the panel.
Yeah, sure. I'll try. So I think one thing that obviously, you know, people talk about that is relevant is, you know, tariffs. The threat of tariffs is partially potentially a policy move, but also leverage. Obviously, we saw that over the weekend with what happened with the Colombia deportee situation, immediate threat of tariffs and a quick sort of stand down from Colombia in terms of their perspective there. But I do think that more broadly speaking, you know, that can work in certain instances, but it definitely will serve to agitate trading partners across the globe, especially to the extent that it is used in that sort of a very aggressive leverage perspective. And it may not be as effective, or it may cause, you know, friction in the system, let's say, in terms of the cooperation aspects that I think Jen was talking about earlier. Just this whole idea of geopolitical tensions and trade tensions and sort of using that bully club effectively, it may produce results, but I think there's also risks that go into that. So I do think that sort of broadly speaking, you're entering a period of more geopolitical uncertainty. I think we've definitely already seen that a week or two into the new administration. And I think that, you know, Trump is pursuing sort of longer term strategic goals in terms of U.S. manufacturing and self-subsistence and that sort of thing, that may not necessarily be aligned with very short-term economic gains. And so that is a risk that people are weighing sort of seriously right now, I think. And I do think with respect to immigration, you know, there's talk about deportations, but I would say the much bigger factor is the lack of new supply, so to speak, in the illegal immigrant market. That basically if that was going from a couple million a year of sort of new entrants who are mostly probably looking for work in the U.S. and that's gone down to a much smaller number, to the extent that that's been a driver of growth, especially in payrolls data. I think that's one of the big gaps, but that's kind of strange in the employment data is that payroll data, both by non-farm payrolls and ADP report, are pretty positive and continue to be positive, whereas a household survey, which may not reflect sort of that illegal immigrant population, has been flat for almost 2 years and looks not great at all. So I do think that it's unclear exactly how this new administration is going to sort of, you know, what the net effects are going to be across all these different sort of economic indicators. But I do think that we're entering a period of more relative uncertainty.
Thank you, Les Baer. The bond freak, Randy Woodard himself. You had a question for the panel, Randy?
Thanks for having me on here last minute. I have a question for the panel, and this is something I've been kind of developing over the last few weeks. You know, when you watch a lot of Elon Musk's tweets and retweets, it's kind of interesting. So here's my question. So if he's successful, or Doge in general and Trump in general, clearly they got their eye on cutting a ton of jobs, government jobs. He also had an interesting tweet this morning where not only is it, I think he said, this guy said that the jobs are making up like 19% of all employment, but also the funding of, you know, nonprofit jobs, you know, like DEI studies and things like that. It takes it up to like 24%. So I'm just thinking, if they start cutting all these jobs, they're successful in doing that, then you get into all the funding of the crazy type of projects that they're starting, like, and I don't know if this 50 million for condoms for Gaza is true or not. It sounds nuts, but programs like that in the United States, and they got the deportations of the recent illegals that are receiving benefits all over the country, which we know is a fact. I guess my question, with all these efforts, how does this not lead to deflation?
No, hey, well, first off, it's great to hear from Randy again. Hope you've been doing well. I think that, you know, if it's a really complicated question with a lot of moving parts. Now, looking first at immigration, we've been talking a lot about deportation, right? And that is definitely happening. But there's another aspect to this as well, and that is skilled migration. Now, there's been a kind of a civil war in MAGA world about this, but it seems like the pro-immigration, skilled immigration part, you know, led by Elon, has prevailed. I mean, Elon himself is a skilled migrant, and Trump, being a big, having a big business, has also had H-1Bs before. And so we could actually balance some of this lack of illegal immigration with higher skilled migration, and that would increase productivity, and that would actually be good for growth and all that. Now, about the other aspect, when it comes to the what's happening with the federal government, I think there's two things happening. Now, Trump is trying to freeze a lot of the grants the federal government gives, which, as Randy noted, basically goes to fund these NGOs and a lot of political activism. That stuff, if the grants dry up, that would increase unemployment. But, you know, as I think there was just a headline a few minutes ago about that being frozen. I imagine they'll get it done, but they not just this iteration. The buyouts is more interesting. I'm not sure how many people will take it. But to Marco's point earlier, though, I think the buyouts are structured so that they won't impact the unemployment rate, because what actually happens is that you tell the government you will resign in 9 months and just continue to collect your salary. And so I'm not sure you would show up in the unemployment statistics until those 9 months expire. But broadly speaking, on inflation and deflation, now, if you have more skilled migration, that is deflationary, I think, because it increases productivity. But also note, bigger picture, we are having a demographic aging that we see in other countries, and that I think is more of a structural inflationary force when we're just looking at the labor market, and many other things could happen. We could have robotics and all that, but I don't think it's clear that we get deflation.
Yeah. I think that Randy asked a really good question. And actually, this is something, the best answer is we don't know. Why? Because we really don't know whether these effects will be like Elon says, or like Trump says, or whether they will do that to the extent that they say that they will do that. So this is one thing. The other thing is something that I mentioned. If they get to lay off 10% of the government workers by offering these benefits, actually they are going to increase the unemployment rate to 5.4%, which is a lot. Like this is something that is going to jump in a month or whenever they actually do that. So this is something that could be problematic for the overall economy, because in that case, actually the private sector could say, okay, if the government is laying off people, then maybe we are going to do the same. And if this gets into some kind of a spiral, it's of course possible that the unemployment could shoot up significantly, and in that case, deflation is not something that is entirely impossible. So I think this is all like we should really be mindful of all of these risks, but at this point we really don't know, because probably no one knows what exactly Trump will do and what these effects will be. We should just go measure by measure and see actually what comes out of it.
Yeah, sure. I'll try my best. But yeah, I mean, we've already seen retaliatory, sort of preemptive retaliatory things from China, talking about restricting rare earth metals. And I think that to the extent that, like I said earlier, that Trump uses this sort of bully club to, you know, as aggressively as he seems that he's going to, there's going to be some sort of backlash and retaliation that will be a negative for people who are importing goods from either final goods or supply chain type raw materials. And I think that, you know, the risk to disrupting trade. I mean, if we go back to, you know, Trump's first administration, one of the big themes in the market was trade wars. And, you know, that was mostly focused with China at the time. I assume that might continue with China going forward. But it is a market concern. And uncertainty is not a good thing. And I think, you know, the prior administration was very much a sort of maintain the status quo of sort of the neoliberal type World Trade Organization type future of global trade. And I think for better or worse, I think that certainty or you know, consistency was a positive for markets. I think that uncertainty brings about a lot of questions that we just don't have the answer to, but will make people think twice about certain investments.
Nothing specific to that. I think the one thing I will note that I think is interesting that we haven't really touched on that's kind of tangential is I do want to highlight that Elon and Trump have not been seen in together as much. The Doge offices have been moved away from Trump's offices. Elon now has to go through the chief of staff. There's they disagreed on at least three things in public in the last several weeks. So I do think there's like some interesting dynamics there. I think reading in the tea leaves there is very interesting as it relates to the direction of policy. I think we might be heading towards a more, as initially expected, more kind of tariff heavy, hardline, you know, Trump is who he said he was type thing. Whereas I think a lot of people maybe thought this was going to be much more kind of just business friendly, more pushing kind of against maybe some of the populist trends we've seen. And I just think I see, especially in the last several weeks, a move back towards that core populist protectionist policy push that we've kind of expected all along.
Looking for some numbers here, and then I want to dive a little bit deeper into the tariffs conversation, and I have a lot of topics I want to cover about the markets. So we'll give this just a beat here. So as expected, maybe not surprising anyone at all, given the 99.5% probability FedWatch had posted, the Federal Reserve has paused interest rate cuts, keeping rates the same. I'm going to give panelists a moment here to kind of look through the initial report, take a peek at some dot plots. So please forgive any silence just for a moment here while panelists have a moment to look things
over. So this is right now just off the cuff. It's being interpreted as somewhat hawkish because they deleted this line, inflation. Last time they said inflation has made progress towards the committee's 2% objective. And this time they deleted that and just left inflation remains somewhat elevated. And, you know, I think that's kind of strange because we did have a pretty good inflation print at CPI. So we'll hear more about this statement at the presser. But so far, it seems like the market is thinking this is the Fed being unhappy about inflation progress.
The conference board did say pretty recently, I think about a week ago, that they're feeling that inflation is remaining stickier than anticipated. I think it was 12-month inflation expectations increased from 5.1% to 5.3% this month. And I think Delawatt has said that the 2025 forecast is actually 3.8% or somewhere around there.
So that's correct. The inflation expectations by the consumer surveys have drifted up. One interesting wrinkle is that it's very partisan. So there's a really good breakout by political party. And if you were a Democrat, your inflation expectations are like at above 4% now. And if you're a Republican, your inflation expectations are around zero. So that averages somewhat above median. Higher than last time. So there is some political wrinkle there.
I would just quickly add to that point. It's a great point, but it's kind of an anecdote, but the small business survey is also very much influenced by those Republican versus Democrat leanings. Generally, small business owners tend to lean to the right, and a lot of attention has been given to some of those positive readings from the small business survey in terms of hiring expectations, business expectations in the past couple months, but there's definitely a political factor that's at play in those specific surveys.
I think it was the Financial Times as well that were saying there's prediction of that rise in inflation, again, pretty along along partisan lines, due to those protectionist, isolationist policies that I was talking about earlier, that prioritization of America first over even cost of living concerns. And so those forecasts were kind of edging a little more on the upper end as well. And anything spicy in the data drop before I bring us right back to the topics before?
Yeah, no, I'm just looking at sort of bond yields. I mean, bond yields, I think, are up 3 or 4 basis points on the long end, which is, obviously reflects a little bit of hawkishness. But I think in prior meetings, we've seen that, those rates move by 10 or 15 basis points on announcement. So I think it is sort of, a little bit hawkish, but maybe not as much much of a surprise as prior meetings.
That actually gives me a good lead in to break us into more of a market discussion here. The 10-year treasury yield specifically has been climbing toward that 5%. I know we kind of hammered that nail a little bit too deeply into the wood the last time we spoke. But again, 10-year yield climbing toward that 5% again, despite the Federal Reserve cutting those interest rates by a full percentage point since last fall. And some analysts actually attribute this to Trump's incoming policies on tax cuts, those tariffs we discussed, and the immigration actions we've already discussed as well. And so I'm wondering, I'll start with Jem on this one, how else and how much the current administration's policies might further influence long-term Treasury?
Yeah, so I think there's this real push and pull happening here. It's not a surprise that yields are kind of stuck. To me, there's this real, how do I describe it? There's this real secular structural inflationary push, across the board, if you don't see it by now, right? The structural, like, core inflationary pressures are there. Employment continues to be quite strong. That said, there is a overhang of supply in markets and assets that's coming to market. That's part of what's pushing the yields, supporting the yields. But at the same time, that's an overhang for markets. And I think the point that gets really misunderstood by most market participants is how reflexive markets are themselves. We have this situation where if we were to see a decline in equity markets on increased venture, increased IPOs, increased private equity, re-leveraging, all the things that are likely to come in. Reminder, we're 4% away from the lows, 4 years, I apologize, away from the lows in interest rates at this point. A lot of refinancing has to happen. A lot of people need to come to market. With markets up 50%, there's a lot of people intend to do that. And so there's this overhang based on a lag of these effects of interest rates coming down the pipe. And that overhang for asset prices is real. And in the face of not supporting that with liquidity from the Fed, like at least proactively, the market has a problem because liquidity that the Fed supplies is almost inconsequential relative to, let's say, a 20% type drawdown or so in financial markets. You know, there's $100 trillion of equities globally, plus another $100 trillion of things that are tied, like private equity. Markets do decline that amount. You're talking about $20 to $40 trillion, the T, dollars of collateral removal from the market. So there's a real momentum factor here. And I do think the markets are broadly really trying to suss out here. I think I highlighted this in another conversation. You know, if the Fed is going to get out ahead of these issues with liquidity. So I think this lack of issuing more liquidity here is a problem for markets. I think the wait and see in this instance is going to be a problem where the Fed ends up being behind. And I do think that the structurally cyclically deflationary pressures that are being projected by others in here are relevant. I think they're important. I think they work exactly in contrast to these structural inflationary pressures. And I do think we're going to have this real push and pull here for a while between cyclical slowdown, yet still very structural policy-driven, politics-driven inflation. So I know I covered a lot of ground there, but you know, the key here is the reflexivity of markets themselves and the supply coming to market broadly for assets writ large in markets over the next year, and the lack of liquidity being provided proactively against that, and how we could really find ourselves in a cyclical deflationary environment in the context of a very structurally inflationary environment. In other words, stagflationary environment. And that's kind of the worst of both worlds.
Hey, Randy, welcome back. You had something to add to the discussion from earlier?
All right, I'll do it real quick. Mike Green, Simplify Asset Management, did an awesome interview with Anna Wong at Bloomberg. She's a badass economist at Bloomberg. You can get that, I think, on YouTube or his site. He talks a lot about tariffs and really, really excellent commentary from her. Essentially, she said, if he goes like he did before, he's going to do very targeted tariffs. And she really doesn't think it's going to be inflationary. But she goes into great detail. I think that's worth everybody going and listening to. And then in addition to that, I'm curious, and this is probably for Joseph. Hey, Joseph, have you been following that Cleveland new tenant rent index?
I've seen one of them. I don't know if it's Cleveland. Is that the one you tweeted out? It seems like it's going down a lot, right? It's a leading indicator.
Timmy jumped my shit on Twitter for that. So I think because it got a lot of attention. So he was kind of giving me grief about it. But this is something I think, Pat, and again, correct me if I'm wrong. I think at the last meeting, this is something Powell brought up with this market-based inflation. And I believe he was referring specifically to the new tenant index by Cleveland, which basically, if you guys aren't familiar with, it's real simple. It's what goes into PCE and CPI, shelter, they try to measure it. But, you know, leases have terms and it takes time for leases to come to term, renegotiate or vacate the property and then have a new renter come in. So Cleveland developed a process and it's a pretty neat paper. You can look it up where they're just measuring new rents on existing properties that are changing hands. And it just came in minus 2.43%. And I put that out there and Timoros said, well, that's misleading because there was revisions to old numbers that were higher, which great. You get paid by the Wall Street Journal. It's amazing you could come up with that. But the number's extremely negative and the trend is down significantly. And I actually added that to this chat room that we're on this call. I'm curious, Joseph, or anybody else. I mean, you know, that's what, 25-30% of CPI, PCE or whatever. I mean, what happens if that does start going negative? And what happens if that, you know, pulls us below their magical 2%?
So I'll add to that. I think that the point that Nick was making around the revisions is that it seems that numerous times over the past year, you've seen negative print from the initial release of that survey that then gets revised up to something in the positive territory by a large margin. So I think he was maybe cautioning against looking at that one negative print.
He was, but I will say, yes, you're right. I mean, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say large revisions. It took it from slightly negative to plus 1%, which, you know, if you look at the trend right now, the all tenant index is still at plus 3.18. So this, you know, this negative, the trend is clearly lower. So, but I agree with you, and he's right. But this time it came at minus 2.43. So, I mean, you know, or maybe it gets adjusted back up to positive. I don't know. But I mean, that if Powell mentioned the damn index, it's something you ought to pay attention to because it's getting pretty severe.
No, I agree with that. I do think that the broad point that I was making, that you're making as well, is that there's still going to be, because of the lag effect of how they calculate inflation for PCE, and given these sort of mild near-term readings on a new tenant rent index, that we can expect to continue to have deflation in that critical category of shelter going forward. I think that's definitely something that the Fed is looking at and is you know, anticipating going forward. And I think that's a good point to make.
Yeah, that's a fascinating. I tell everybody, Cleveland, just go to their site, new tenant rent. They did a little write up on it, and it's fascinating. Now, Timorous calls it, you know, what is it, a test or whatever, but an experiment, I should say. But if you go look at it, I just posted from 2004 up until today. It's, you know, it's clearly more volatile. It should be, right? It's new tenant rent, but the all tenant rent clearly follows it. It's a very, I think, a very good correlation. So it's going to be, unfortunately, only updated quarterly. So you got to wait 3 months for the next summer, which kind of sucks.
I agree that tariffs may not be inflationary. I mean, there's a lot of levers, a lot of layers that this has to go through. For example, when we had tariffs in 2018, 2019, you can go and look at the inflation data. Inflation was actually below the Fed's target. And that's because when you put tariffs on, there's a lot of mitigating mechanisms. First off is, of course, your currency strengthens, so that even though when you import, you have to pay a higher price, your currency strengthens. And so that takes off some of the increase. Secondly, what we saw happen in 2019 was, although prices did go up, what happened was that the producers, the businesses, ate that by having lower margins and did not pass that on. There's a study of over 100,000 prices at that time, and they found that overall there was no pass through the consumers. Isolated, there were some goods like washing machines, but other than that, not really. And of course, you have substitution effects, where if something that's imported becomes more expensive, you just buy less of it and buy something else instead. So it's not super clear that tariffs would be inflationary. It's totally possible, but it's not a slam dunk. And like I mentioned before, it didn't happen in 2019.
Jim, I want to pick on you for about just a few minutes here about a conversation you had on Top Traders Unplugged, where you mentioned that you expect equity vol to continue to be compressed and underperform over the next half decade or more, while you said you expect everything else, such as Forex vol, to be more favorable opportunities. Now, kind of a two-parter a little bit, could you first give a short rundown on what you mean by that, as well as kind of cover a little bit of what you spoke with on that show about how investors could better hedge in the years to come?
Yeah, I think it's important to be mindful of time frames when we're talking about these things. I, you know, am talking over kind of longer time frames. So, you know, this doesn't mean we won't have spikes in equity vol or opportunities. But I think the market structure is very much moving towards, I think as we move through time, it'll be even more that the case. Moving towards a structure where markets become increasingly inexpensive through not going much of anywhere. On top of that, I think we find Again, if history is any indicator, we find in these types of periods relative dollar strength, as we've seen, relative, fundamental value to certain parts of the market that are themselves hedges to inflation. But that it becomes counteracted. There's a push-pull of, higher over time price to earnings, sorry, higher to interest rates that create, lower multiples over time. And so you really just get this push-pull, right? Like if you look at 68 to 82 as a proxy, last time we saw interest rates rise, like the way we lost money, the way the system rebalanced, it was essentially the market just went nowhere for 14 years. Yes, we had 40% type declines. We had multiple recessions. We had a lot of crises. And you look back at the 60s, 70s, you're like, that was a volatile time. We didn't go anywhere in nominal terms. You know, in a world of nominal illusion, the shaving of the coins took care of everything over time. And so whereas most of the focus tends to be on hedging equity vol, the real problem is not hedging the quick, fast performance, underperformance of markets over this period. It is a very different type of market structure. The real concern is how do you protect the value of your hard-earned money against the power of time and the compounding loss of just the value of your money. I think people get caught so much in the short term, and that's for a good reason because the market has done so well and things have appreciated so tremendously in the last 40 years with incredibly low inflation. And yet we've had to worry multiple times about 70% type declines. The tails have been way bigger, whether it's the great financial crisis or the tech bubble. So this idea that you own an asset and then you own the left tail, and then that performs well because it allows you to just stay long the market will do incredibly poorly in my mind in this world. And meanwhile, things like private equity that have 10-year duration locked up and can avoid worrying about the mark to market and the steep drawdowns because they come back quickly will all of a sudden work out to be one of the worst types of things to invest in because you're locked up in long duration with low liquidity, with leveraged equity that then has all kinds of other structural closeted away problems that don't go away in 2-4 years that last 10, 15. So equity vol is not, the left tail is not the solution. I'm talking about long timeframes, not this week, next week, but vol in certain parts of the market, which have been relatively mundane. And, if you talk about bond vol up until a couple of years ago, that's where money went to die for 30, 40 years. The Fed controlled the bond market everything traded, hundreds of thousands up, fractions of a bip wide. That's already changed. That's not going to, we're going to see more of this for a long time to go, but more importantly than even bond vol is FX vol. One of the greatest performing assets in a world of global conflict and protectionism, that's not going away. Structural inflation and power dynamics. Everything we talked about is cross market dislocations in a world the Fed cannot pin down volatility and control. So there are many different ways to play hedges and to interact, and that has with markets to get convexity and in the words of David Drudge, like have breaks for your portfolio. But you really need to be focused on the right breaks. And I think people are all focused on the VIX or equity vol primarily as the way to do that. When the reality is there are much more effective ways. I'll add a second kind of corollary to that is because it's where everyone hedges and there's increasingly more people adding tail hedges to try and protect against what is not likely to be a tail event. That's also what will not was least likely to perform. You know, all the structured product issuance, which we've talked about, which is increasingly a way to kind of trade non-correlated, not two-dimensionally, but three dimensions to capture more non-correlated edge, is just increasing year over year dramatically and will continue to provide supply into the market. And all the hedges that come into the VIX will ultimately also drive a reflexive like underperformance there over kind of more long to medium term outcomes. Again, not a call for this week, next month, this year. I want to be clear. I'm increasingly looking for a top processing. Again, not a quick vol event here, but a top processing in the market. And I think negative beta, in the right ways, playing ball the right way, can perform in the next year, but it will, again, similar to 22, be a disappointment if you're just focused on buying kind of convex vol on some shorter time duration. So I'll leave that there.
So real quick, I know we're running close to Jay Powell's presser here, but I want to touch a little bit on consumer confidence and sentiment while we have a few moments left. This month, U.S. consumer confidence increased for the second consecutive month, Conference Board's index falling to 104.1, 109.5 in December. University of Michigan also reported that same phenomenon, with it declining to 71.1 from 74 in December. And so kind of from that trader's point of view, I want to pick Marco and Last Bear's brain on this one before we get to the presser. What are kind of the key factors to look out for that are causing consumers to feel less confident in the economy despite seemingly good numbers that we're seeing? Let's start Marco and go Last Bear after.
Yeah, consumer confidence and consumer sentiment, actually, these are things that have been really driven by political bias, like our inflation expectations. This is something that Joseph said. This is something that actually went up in November, December, and now it's coming down a bit to the levels that where it was before the election. So this was really it's really driven by the Trump optimism. This is something that is temporary. Like it's a temporary bump, but after all of this cools off, we are probably going to see both confidence and sentiment going down a bit over the next few months. So this is more like politically driven than it's a real sentiment change. At least from what I've seen by analyzing all the data so far. Because if you also look at some of the other let's say manufacturing indices, services indices, and so on, you will probably see more of expectations going up, not really current conditions going up. Like people are still not really satisfied by what they see, or companies, it doesn't matter. They're still not satisfied with what they see currently, but they are expecting things to improve, and this is why some of these measures have gone up over the past 3 months. But as I said, I'm expecting them to cool off a bit over the next few months.
Yeah, I'll just be super quick. So I think the Michigan sentiment and Consumer Board are kind of have two different methodologies. The Michigan survey definitely weights sort of inflation into it somehow much higher. And if you look at the Michigan sentiment survey, that went from one of the lowest readings of all time in early 2022 when inflation was at 9%. That's been going upwards on sort of a longer term trend, even if it's volatile and has come off in the past 2 months or so. So I think that's one important point. And I think also if you look at like consumer delinquencies and credit cards, that number actually started to go down for the first time in at least 2 years. In the most recent data, you had really positive results from sort of mid-tier credit cards like Discover and Capital One that both showed delinquencies sort of declining for the first time in some time. At the top end, American Express showing like 7 or 8% sort of year-over-year growth in terms of their card spend. So I think it's tough to get too negative on the consumer at this point.